Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the show this week, we'll be talking communication with Mikhail Krogris and Roman Schepler, the duo who've released books on good decision-making and other vital everyday interactions in the past, have a new one about getting your point across, Rob, the very clearly titled The Communication Book.
We'll also be hearing from the filmmaking legend Werner Herzog. He'll be explaining some of his craft a little later in the show.
And we'll be meeting curator Kathleen Soriano and artist Liz Radil. Their new book, Madam and Eve, focuses on depictions of women in art made by women in art.
That is all to come, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here with the news look ahead, and we'll play some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. It's been a busy old week.
It has. Left and right.
Yeah.
Up and down. I don't know where I'm going with this. I reckon we'll feel edified, positively edified by the end of the programme.
And who do we get to do the newsletter?
The arch exponent, you're asking me.
The arch exponent.
Maybe Fernando Augusto Pacheco?
Let's get him in. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando. Fernando, welcome to the programme. How lovely to have you here.
How lovely to be here as well.
What's going to happen next week? I bet it's going to be great.
It's going to be great. And, you know, usually my first story is usually like a political story. But this time I decided to start in the design world because it is the most important date for people who work in this industry. But it's, of course, Salone del Mobile in Milan, you know, the largest furniture fair in the world. And I think, you know, our design team is going to be there. It is an important date for Monaco. You're going to hear updates on the radio. And, of course, we'd have a new beautiful product as well, which is in my hands here, the Salone Weekly.
This is a lovely thing. And Rob, you've worked on how many of these newspapers previously? The summer and winter iterations. Probably dozens.
Dozens.
But this is a one-off for the design denizens of Milan, isn't it, Faye? And it is a thing of beauty, I must say.
And it's not just kind of, what to see at Salone as well. You know, I think there's a lot of important interviews with Richard Rogers, the architect, and there's lovely, lovely features. But of course, if you are going to be there in Milan, we do have a Salone selection here. I'm quite interested in bathroom design, actually.
Yeah,
and there's this new collection by Vitra in Turkey, and it just looks very nice. And I think this could be definitely a good recommendation.
What else is going to be happening next week, Fernando?
Well,
I wonder.
If you don't mind, I am staying in Italy because today actually something perhaps almost as fun as design, with wine. Today's the first day of Vin Italy, which is, again, the largest wine fair in the world, and Chiara's going to be there. What a fantastic job to check out.
Chiara's going. Wow.
And I was asking her, you know, Chiara, what should I know about, you know, this fair? I must say, it's not only about Italian wine. I think there's 14,500 wine varieties. I didn't know there was that many.
Whoa.
And Chiara was telling me that in Italy, usually you just drink the wine from your region. So clearly she just drinks the wine from Piedmont. And I have my favorite. I love a good Nobile di Montepulciano from the Tuscany region.
Oh, yeah. That's big reds.
I like big reds.
Do you?
I do like, and yeah. I'm not a big fan of white wine. It's terrible. But of course, you know, and it's interesting how international is becoming. I think China is becoming a massive market for wine. And I think that's going to be one of the trends this year as well. Big sales from US, Canada. So it's certainly not a little local Italian event for winemakers.
That sort of what's the trade really talking around? The real sort of B2B angle.
Yeah.
So that's what we'll be digging into on Monocle 24. Chiara will be reporting.
I love that. Do we have a third wheel on our cart?
We do. It's an event close to my heart because actually I just did a piece for The Urbanist on how much I love record stores. Basically, that's the piece, you know. So it's me talking. So it's Record Store Day on Saturday. Mm-hmm. It's a UK event. This year, 245 independent record shops who participate on that. So basically, you know, sometimes they invite artists to sign, they release like new vinyls. You know, basically it's a celebration of the record shop and of records, you know, because as you know, vinyl sales are growing. Actually, even CDs, they're not going that bad. You know, last year, I think they dropped only 3-4%. So it's just a marvelous day.
Fernando, thank you so much for brightening up this sort of blustery Sunday. Faye, thank you very much indeed.
Mikael Krogerus from Finland is editor of Das magazine in Switzerland, and it's there that his work has grown with the Swiss creative Roman Scheppeler. The duo have created a series of books looking at how we go about life and asking whether we can go about it a little better.
Their new title, The Communication Book, looks at some time-tested methods and also new ideas about how best to get one's point across. We could probably do with a read of that, Rob. And it follows titles from the pair such as The Decision Book and The Question Book.
And I'm delighted to say that Mikael and Roman join us right now. You've written the book. Was it written from first-hand experience, or was it written from learning it the hard way and getting lots of things wrong, I wonder?
We started from our own life,
yeah,
realizing that we're bad at conversations. But then we realized we're in good company because nobody's really good at conversations.
We're all awful at it,
yeah,
in parts.
Then again, we found out that there are lots of theories in science behind how people communicate, and there are many tools that we could actually learn. So we tried to, okay, let's look into it and see if there are any things we can use and that our readers can use.
We were asked to write about communication from the Museum of Communication if we could design a room and explain the very complicated theories of communication for them. But along the way, we started then finding what we are really interested in.
Our listeners won't know this, but there's an interesting dynamic going on between Roman and Mikael today. What's happened? Has someone eaten someone else's lunch? What's going on in here?
Now, this is how we work.
Okay, I mean, I like it.
The readers might not know that. Our book's always a short page text, which
yes,
I write, and it's always a drawing, a diagram,
yeah,
explaining the theory, and Roman does that.
Yeah.
So we fight over every page.
Good.
He doesn't like my text, I doesn't like his diagrams, and that way we work with...
And since this
forward
is a radio show, I have to talk for once and not
yeah,
draw, so
exactly.
I'm very happy.
Well, it's funny, because we've already had this idea of the science, if you like, or the theory of conversation. If you are someone that struggles with making conversation, is it wrong to look at it as a scientific process? Because it's a bit more intuitive, isn't it, than that? It's about reacting to people. It's very human. You can't be too clinical about it.
No, of course, the bottom line is intuitive. We realize I say something and someone smiles or looks at me, I can tell if he's really listening or if he's just nodding his head because he learned that in the book.
I was nodding away. Now I'm starting to doubt myself.
That's why it's so dark in here. We've dimmed the lights to kind of put them off the scent.
We're hiding.
That's
we're
what
hiding.
We've kind of done, exactly. I was particularly intrigued by one of the chapters in the book, which was talking about in sort of 19th century Europe, the salon was in fashion and small talk became the fashion. And the perfect dinner guest, you write, Mikael, is the person that can ask the perfect questions rather than necessarily give the perfect answers or just waffle on about their own life and their own opinions and all the rest of it. This is something that you could probably glean from fiction of that era and diary entries from that era and stuff like that. How did you hit upon that fact? Because it seems like an incontestable fact once you've read it, but how did you arrive at that point?
Well, that's the famous Proust questionnaire.
Uh-huh.
Proust, the French writer, apparently, I think that's just a story, but apparently he designed a questionnaire having in the side of his pocket if he doesn't know what to ask.
That's
because
good,
if you always
it?
Ask the boring questions, like nowadays the boring question is, what do you do for work?
Mm-hmm.
That's a boring question. But if you ask someone, when did you for the last time do something for the first time? It starts a process.
Yeah.
And everyone can answer that question. And Proust's approach was that all his questions, I think it's a questionnaire of 35 questions, every person should be able to answer that question. So it's not
you
about
knowledge.
You don't
have to be an expert.
No,
or
no, no.
Exactly.
It's just give the answer. And the spontaneous or honest answer is always the best answer.
It shouldn't be a question that can be answered with yes or no, because then you can just... it's not a conversation.
It's a cul-de-sac.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the second, let's say, aspect to a good question would be the answer shouldn't require prior knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just ask a question, so what do you think about the Brexit negotiation at the moment? I would say, I have no idea. I need some.
Nobody has any idea.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But then you would show me that you know. So that's not a conversation starter. And the third one, does the question contains the word I in it? Because questions that start with, I've been to London, so what do you think about London?
Yeah.
That implies that I want to talk about my stay in London.
So you're sort of
London.
Cutting the other person
yeah.
out there.
So it's not very social to try to avoid those three points in a question.
And now, Roman, we've talked already about the fact that you sort of illustrated a number of these, and that Proust questionnaire is quite interesting. It's a sort of a flow chart that goes through. One of the ones that struck me was this graph with a sort of U-shaped curve, but it demonstrates l'esprit d'escalier, which was a phenomenon that I was familiar with and have myself punished myself because of. Maybe you can, or you could both remind us
yeah.
what is that phenomenon? Because I'm sure all our listeners will be familiar with it.
Well, l'esprit l'escalier is French and means basically the staircase wit, which means before you go to a job interview, you are fully prepared and you walk up the stairs to the room where the interview is going to take place. And once you enter the room, you forget everything, you have a blackout, you give stupid answers, you appear like in a radio show. But the minute you leave the room, the minute Rom and I are going to leave this room, we all have these crystal clear arguments. And when we step down the stairs, we can come up with these razor sharp arguments and witty lines. And we're always smarter afterwards.
Yeah.
And this is the stairway's wit. We're very witty when we go downstairs. And in psychology, this is called choking. So we choke on the expectations.
There is something in this about you sort of recommended a 5-second rule on this, so that when someone asks you a question, say in an interview, you know, as in a job interview, you sit there and sort of stroke your beard. Are you allowed to do that, or is that a bit too,
maybe too much,
too wankerish? you look to the heavens and you think of what, but it's to give yourself time to breathe. But it's not just to give people time to breathe. There's two halves of this. There's making yourself look a little bit more clever and changing the expectation of the listener, I suppose.
Yeah, it's two things. This is a tip by psychologists. He said, If you are not very spontaneous, then don't try to be it. Because if you try to be it, you will not be it at all. So if someone asks you a question and you are unsure, take your time. And then deliver the answer.
Man, he's clever, isn't he?
He's good.
Yes,
he's good.
He's good.
And Roman, what about you? Do you have devices that you yourself use? And I guess when you're working on a book like this, do you begin to recognise traits in yourself? So I'm a bit of an inveterate, a steepler of my fingers whilst pondering a difficult question, which obviously, again, this doesn't work on radio. But were there devices that you realised that you yourself had used in conversational terms that you ended up almost having to illustrate in the book?
Yeah, it's the counterpart of talking. It's to listen. And I just discovered that it's extremely difficult to listen for me. I mean, there are people, they do it just naturally, but I'm quite extroverted and talkative. And the best way I can do it now, or I look at myself, is when I have little arguments with my partner. That's where I can see where I'm so bad at listening. And it just helped in a way that I'm aware of the fact that listening is the counterpart of talking. That's one thing. And the other is I have a 3-year-old boy. So I can really see how it is if you have this nagging guy asking the whole day, why? But daddy, why? 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 And it's more a linguistic thing that's part of the communication theories. So how give you good answers to 3-year-old kids? So it's very challenging. And we even have some included some parenting tips. And I have to admit, some of them are really from my own life.
He's literally written the book on it, Tom.
That's useful. Well, those struck me as well. I was humiliated yesterday. I have a 2.5-year-old and I was using 2 tennis rackets to row the sofa on the room with him. We're singing the Row the Boat song. Halfway through, he just stopped, got out, and he said, "That's not a rowboat, Daddy." And I was like, what is it? And he went, "It's a sofa," and then walked out. Yeah. 2-year-old! Sassed me! Right there!
Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's...
No, the best is... We just moved for 1 year from Switzerland to Valencia for a sabbatical. And he was in that, "No, I don't like that." So I say no all the time. And he said no all the time. And then I tried to figure out, how can I stop it? And I said, "Just, you always say no." And he said, "No." And then I looked at him. And then he really realized that he always said no. And then it was turning into a fun part of our conversation.
Do we sort of almost train ourselves out of skills? If you go back to the kind of early, you know, the guys who believe in linguistics, it's all innate, or some of them would have you believe. Do we sometimes train ourselves out, Mika, of the ability to converse? Do we lose a natural inclination to be good at conversation?
Yeah, at least if you're online. There we lose something very important, because it's very easy to write, "That was a stupid radio show." But it's very hard for me to look you in the eye and say, "I don't like your radio show." Because then I see a reaction. And if I get a reaction, I realize, maybe I insulted you, and that doesn't feel good. But if you write something only online, we miss out on a huge, important part of conversation. And that is the nonverbal conversation of me feeling you or seeing how you feel.
Mm. And you travel talking about this kind of thing as well. Are parts of the world better at things than other parts of the world?
With cliches, of course, they're always wrong and always right.
Yeah.
So you have, like, you just have to be very careful with it. And your listeners might know experiences with Germans, they just say straight up what they think.
Yeah.
And they feel good about it. And they even think it's a compliment if they tell you something.
Yeah.
And from Central Europe, we realized the Britons, everyone is funny. Everyone can deliver a joke, even those who are not funny. And that is very intimidating for us, who just like have to write down the jokes and then train them and then deliver them.
So yeah, actually tell us about some of the workings behind this book, actually, because it is it's beautifully bound. It's a handsome thing. It's going to look great in bookshops. I'm sure it will sell very well. How did you edit it, I suppose? Because there's all sorts of fluffy peripheral arguments you could have made with this, but each argument is a spread. It's got the lovely drawing from Roman. It's got your great text, Mikhail. How difficult was it to stick to your formula, I wonder?
It's reduction. We started off with, I don't know, maybe 300 theories and methods. Mm. And that was a huge work, as you can imagine. And since this book is based on this exhibition, permanent exhibition in the museum, we had to have more because there are more to see than in our book. Then we reduced it because sometimes it was a very, very complicated theory that we had really to say, I mean, even if we are able to reduce it on a one-pager and in one drawing, what's the sense of it? Because then it would be too much simplified. And others, we didn't find a nice drawing. In others, they fell out because the museum said that's not interesting for us. We have some that we think, is it the communication theory or not? Because there's not a straight border to tell, is this one or not? So there were different angles how we put together. And then, I don't know, the editing from German to English could be an interesting fact.
Yeah, I mean, what we have to do then was that we talked to a British editor and said, here's the book, the German version. Mm-hmm. And the Germans are much more interested in the why than the how. They want to know, why do we ask questions like this? The Brits want to know, how do I ask a good question? So we have to change a little bit, going away from theory and going more into tips and methods.
Aha, uh-huh, right.
Because the book is, in a sense, it's kind of a primer. And I wonder, do you ever idly think of someone you would like to read the book? I mean, for example, the current incumbent in the Oval Office sitting in Washington, D.C., people suggest could learn a thing or two about good communication. Would you actually be pleased if someone said, I know what I'm going to get President Trump, this book, that's what he needs?
I would love to give it to Mr. Trump. For example, we have this chapter on negotiation strategies, and there are basically two schools. One is the hard negotiation, and that is not enough to win, someone has to lose. And I think Donald Trump attended that school.
I think he did, yeah.
And it would be cool that he would read the book and he would find the soft negotiation skill, which is more of us trying to meet at a table and both parties leave the negotiation table with more than they expected to have. So that's the fine art of negotiation. And that's something I think he could, he could learn. So I would love him to read it.
I think they're profound lessons for at least me.
I'm inspired.
Yeah, I am as well.
I'm absolutely inspired.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in. The book is The Communications Book, 44 Ideas for Better Conversations Every Day. Mikhail and Roman, thank you very much indeed. Time for some new music. This is from California's anthemic post-punks Wax Idols, and it's called Scream.
Wax Idols from Oakland there with Scream, and we'll be hearing from Werner Herzog after this.
Filmmaker Werner Herzog needs little introduction, but we'll still give him a little one. The legendary talent behind films such as Aguirre, Wrath of God and Fitzcarraldo is also just as well known for documentaries such as Grizzly Man and, lo and behold, Reveries of the Connected World.
Recently, Monocle's Ziona Zulkifli met Herzog at the Hong Kong International Film Festival. They began by discussing what he calls an avalanche of requests from young filmmakers that inspires him to share his knowledge on filmmaking with a new generation.
Today you can do a feature film for theatres with your cell phone.
Yeah.
We have seen examples, and quite successful examples. So technology is becoming smaller and easier and more affordable. When young filmmakers come in, they complain, nobody wants to finance my films. So I do not follow what they are trying because I'm not in the culture of complaint. Mm-hmm. I've never been into that, and today it's initiative that you have to take a little bit of money that you can earn as a taxi driver in a few months, and then you can make a feature film.
Is that one of your favorite advice to, for example, this morning you came from a masterclass. How did it go? What do you usually hope young filmmakers, for example, leave your masterclasses with?
Well, you can never predict what they make out of it when I do a masterclass. It's normally not really sitting there and teaching. I like to have a discourse with young filmmakers and listen to what are their problems, what are their obstacles, what are their fears, what are their perspectives and their visions. So I'm always trying to encourage, and I keep saying you have to take initiative. You can make a film for literally no money, and it can be a film for theaters. You have to have a clear vision, otherwise you shouldn't even start. And you should stick to your identity, personal identity and also cultural identity. So don't try when you are living in, let's say, in India, don't try to make Hollywood films. You better make the Indian, the Bollywood version of movies. So it's a cultural identity, and you have to be proud of it, and you have to work within your own cultural environment.
In your masterclasses, are they a concentrated version of what the lessons filmmakers who go to your Rogue Film School might learn?
In a way, there's, for example, a masterclass online. That's a company, and I have done something like 6 hours, but it's very, very concentrated, very intense. And of course, I'm speaking about all sorts of aspects of filmmaking, let's say editing or film and music, or how do you work with actors? How do you handle money? How do you create your long-term survival? You see, it's easy to make one or two films and then you will disappear unless you haven't somehow learned how to survive long-term. And of course, I'm speaking about those things, and I try to pass on what young people want to know from me. And of course, I have long experience now in the profession, and it has become like an avalanche coming at me. And I mean a huge avalanche of young people who want to either learn from me or be my assistant. But if I announce today publicly or on the internet I'm seeking for an assistant, I would have 30,000 people applying. And when I do something like a masterclass or the Rogue Film School, I try to give it a systematic answer. I try to give an organized form of an answer. The masterclass, which is online, which is not my company, gives you a good idea how I would pass on what is demanded from me in terms of experience and expertise. Mm-hmm.
So you said that you try to give a systematic answer to their questions. Is this a big part of your process? Are you a very systematic filmmaker, would you say?
I think when you're a filmmaker, you have to have a certain amount of discipline and you have to proceed systematically, but we shouldn't stick to this term too long. It is so amorphous and so chaotic that's coming at me that I try to put some sort of order, certain subjects. I'm dealing the next half hour now with that subject alone, and we'll move on to this or that. So otherwise it would be too much random, and it wouldn't be helpful for anyone. I have the feeling, a sense of duty, because I have seen a lot, I have worked a lot, and I do have answers for a young filmmaker who come at me.
Can you describe a little a bit about your process as you're making a film? For example, recently I read a Q&A with Joshua Oppenheimer, and he described the way you mark your sequences with one exclamation mark, two exclamation marks, three exclamation marks, and then make a film out of those marked with three exclamation marks, for example. So I was wondering if you could describe that process in a little bit.
Well, it is a procedure I do during editing, and Joshua Oppenheimer, of course, is very dear to me. He approached me when he was already into editing, and he had questions for me, and I tried to be as helpful as I could. And when you have your footage, when you have done your film, I look at my film material, at my filmed footage only once, together with an editor. It's always better to have more eyes on than your own on your materials. And I write in longhand something I call the log books. Not on my laptop, because then you forget it easily, but written down in longhand in the very extraordinary material I mark with exclamation points. It is helpful because I never have to go into the material that is not really that good. Some of the material is outright bad. It always happens you end up and something really goes wrong and you just ignore it later. And I do not have to worry so much about, will this material of the best of the best of the best, will it fit together? Answer, yes, it always fits together. Everything that is really intense and has a great amount of substance always fits together, no matter what. It's a mysterious quality of filmmaking.
And earlier you said it's also very important for young filmmakers to have a very clear vision. So this very clear vision, does this come out of after you have ticked the three exclamation points and put them all together, or you already have a clear message that you wanted to tell before?
Now, when I speak about clear vision, it you see, when you have done your film, your shooting, you try to put it into a coherent narrative. And quite often I try to avoid to squeeze my material into a preconceived idea. So it has to breathe. Your material has to breathe. It has its own life all of a sudden. You find out qualities in your children, I'm speaking now in metaphor, that you have never expected, and let it come to life. But otherwise, when I do a film, I would not start a feature film, for example, without having seen it already, like in a movie theater. Mm-hmm. I see an entire film in front of me, and I hear the dialogues, and I see the locations, and because of that, it's very easy for me to write a screenplay.
So let's go back a little bit to the beginning. So I've heard that you fell into this purpose for film after finding a 15-page entry, encyclopedia entry on filmmaking. Is that true?
No, it's a myth in the media or on the internet. It was clear I would be a filmmaker, and I knew I would never go to film school. At that time, hardly any existed, but it was obvious that was not what I wanted to do. And I learned a few basics from some sort of an encyclopedia. I learned about the basic functioning of a celluloid camera, how it mechanically worked, how, for example, you could create slow motion. If you understand the mechanics of a camera, you would understand and can figure out how to create slow motion, for example. And some basic things, what was an optical soundtrack, and what was possible in a laboratory, color gradings and things like this, very condensed, some 12, 15 pages maybe, and I went through it in a few days. And that's basically all you need to make films. It's a disgrace to spend 4 years in film school. You can do it in a week, and then you are qualified to make a film.
You seem very curious about everything around you, even just this morning when I've met you. So you obviously pick up new things as you go along, and you are always experimenting. How has your films changed from that first short that you did to the latest film?
I think I do not need to give the answer. If you look at my early films and what I'm doing today and what I did 20, 25 years ago, of course, I've never stood still. However, you still will see the films have a common life, a common culture, a common worldview. You would immediately, if you saw a film and you saw the first 2 minutes of it, you could, and you hadn't seen the credits, you would know that must have been my film. You could tell.
Yeah.
And how exactly to explain that, I don't know, but I only now I have changed and moved and never stood still, but the very basic vision, the very basic worldview, in a way unchanged.
And you also take a lot of risks for your work as a film director, in terms of being in a dangerous place, for example, or setting impossible tasks like getting a ship at a mountain. How do you get your crew to get with it, like get with the program?
Well, I have never set myself impossible tasks. I think every grown-up man should move a ship over the mountain at least once in his or her life, if you're a young woman. Never impossible tasks, always things that were ultimately doable, but with a high amount of courage. And of course, when you have a very clear vision and when you have a great story, you will find people who would be undeterred and follow you and come along. You find the comrades. If you have a wonderful project, the people who will be on your side will be found. They come, they arrive.
And you're here for the Hong Kong International Film Festival. I'm very curious to know who you admire in the scene here in Asia.
Well, there's quite a few of them. What comes to mind right now is not so much Chinese. Instantly, I thought, for example, of the Apu trilogy made in the late 50s, or Kurosawa, Japanese, and of course some of the great Chinese filmmakers, Zhang Jimou, or Chen Kaige, and others. So there's always extraordinary films coming out from this region.
So tell me, what are you working on right now?
I'm in the middle of doing a film on Mikhail Gorbachev. I have filmed with him twice at the end of last year, and he wants me back. He seems to like me, but he's quite old. He's 87 now. Yeah. His health is not very good, so I was supposed to be in Moscow filming with him 2 weeks ago, but he was, at that time, he was in hospital, and he said, no, don't come. But now he has summoned me in a little more than 2 weeks, or 3 weeks, I will be back in Moscow filming with him. And of course, I will be then, once I have all this done, I have to go into archival footage. So that's a longer procedure, and editing will take some time, but I want to finish it as soon as possible.
Yes, that was one aspect of your films that I love, because I'm a history buff. You always cutting archival footage into your films. Why is that important to you? What does that mean?
I do not put archival footage in all my documentaries, but well, it gives a certain historical dimension to things. And when you are doing something with Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, he has been a person of extraordinary importance for the last decades of the last century, 1980s, and there's nobody left of his importance.
So what's next? That's specifically a film about Mikhail Gorbachev. But in general, what are you focused on? Just making more films?
When I'm leaving here, I'm going to the retrospective that I brought along, I think 20 or 22 films. It will continue in Shanghai and then Beijing. But on my way back to Los Angeles, where I live, I will do some filming in Tokyo for about a week. It's the first steps into a feature film. And I'm also working on a limited series of films that take place in the Brazilian Amazon. And I'm working on a film about Bruce Chatwin, and I'm working on three or four other feature film projects.
Also seemingly very nicely trying to spread your knowledge as well through film schools or master classes. Why do you think that is as important?
Well, for me personally, it's not important that I do a master class, but I try to be helpful. I try to do what I consider my duty. I have a sense of duty.
To what?
When there's such an overwhelming demand of young people to listen to some of my experiences and trying to avoid mistakes. that I have made in my life. I have been full of mistakes, and so I try at least avoid my mistakes. You have to have the privilege to commit your own errors and to make your mistakes, but I simply try to give an organized answer.
Just final question. What is your most memorable film?
Oh, they are all memorable. You cannot ask a mother which one of your five children is your most memorable.
That's always the favorite, though.
No, there's no. The favorite has to be the child that has a defect, the child that has a limp, the child that stutters, the child that is squint-eyed. So you have to embrace that child more closely than the others. In a way, the films that I have made that have more defects than the others, I embrace more closely.
Werner Herzog there in conversation with Monocle's Ziona Zulkifli at the Hong Kong International Film Festival. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Curator and broadcaster Kathleen Soriano's skills have been in demand over the years at art institutions such as the National Portrait Gallery, where she was head of exhibitions and galleries, and the Royal Academy, where she was director of exhibitions as well. You may also know her from her appearances on Portrait Artist of the Year for Sky Arts.
Liz Riddell is an artist whose works sit in the collections of Tate and V&A, among others. She's also a reader in fine art at the Slade School of Fine Art here in London. Together, they've created a new book, Madam and Eve, Women Portraying Women. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly. Perhaps, Kathleen, we can start with you. What was the sort of the founding principle, the idea that sparked this project into life?
I think Liz and I have been friends for a very, very 35 years, long
yes.
time. We felt that there's been a huge injustice, really, to women artists over the years. They just haven't been recognised historically or today. And we all know that that's changing quite dramatically at the moment. But we wanted to be part of marking that change in a way that also celebrated our two lives and our friendships in a way. You know, Liz being an artist, me being a curator working in museums. And it was very important to us that we showed a large number of artists that we felt that people weren't that familiar with. So there were lots of surprises, hopefully, in there, and revelations.
You're telling the story of art history and the female body and women looking at women. Give us some of the key themes, Liz, maybe, that you wanted to get people thinking about.
The beginning of the book tells a story of where women artists are within the generally realised canon of male artists. And we're mainly looking at Western European art. So that first bit goes up until about 50 years ago. And because this also chimes with an anniversary of 50 years since that unfurling of the protest banner that read Women's Liberation, it was unfurled by the feminist group New York Radical Women at the 1968 Miss America pageant. So the book's sort of in two halves, really, and it's also designed to be in two halves. The first bit couches the inner history that we understand or we sort of vaguely know about, but maybe we don't even see the women, so we're trying to bring those women up. And then the second bit actually also produces a perspective on women for the last 50 years. As Kathleen was saying, some that we know, like Yoko Ono, and some that we might really be less familiar with.
But I think you're right to pick up on the idea of the way in which it's divided, being specific, because when we started conversations, you know, we were thinking about the usual framework of motherhood, friendship, sexuality, and then we realised that even those terms are very sort of gender specific. And we tried to sort of challenge ourselves by saying, OK, if this was about male artists or it wasn't just about men and women, how would we divide it? And we thought both about what we wanted to argue, but we also looked at the way in which the pictures were telling those stories for us. And we wanted the chapters to also follow the pattern, really, of our lives today, you know, as you sort of body, story, life, death, ultimately icons, because hopefully we'll all achieve that status in the future world.
it's happening live on the show, I can feel it. And I wanted to talk about some of the artists specifically. You mentioned Yoko Ono. It just got me thinking with her and Marina Abramović and the idea of the female, the empowerment of the body and these kind of themes. You've got a still in here of Yoko Ono's The cutting well, cut piece. Yeah.
That, you know, that's a classic too.
Yeah.
I mean, she could be in the icon section, yeah, really. In fact, we had quite a lot of difficulty
for any of her
with
stuff.
Some of those stuff. Just, yes, because she is such a star.
I do think you're right about that there being a special moment for some of these women artists who suddenly were, yeah, empowered by different media. I mean, Liz wrote a really lovely section. I mean, we do find it hard to identify who wrote what in the book now, but about how when photography and video became a possibility, it wasn't a male, hadn't previously been a male-dominated area. So the women artists were sort of liberated to own it in a way that it was harder really to own it maybe as in painting. And to a certain extent, performance art was slightly part of that.
Well, that was the next thing that I was going to say, really, which I think you are on the case in terms of recognising the new media here and the possibility that women had of getting involved there. And I personally think that that is also to do with the amount of time that you can devote to using photography or doing performance, is that you can, it's not the same practice as going into your painting studio every day and confronting the canvas. It's a different way of managing time. And I think that women, you know, I mean, classically people talk about juggling things more than one thing. Well, I'm not here to defend that or say that's true, but I think that there is definitely an ability to be able to manage certain aspects of time in order to produce completed works that can then be shown in a different way from making paintings, because making paintings is a whole other ball game, and it does require a different way of managing time and also managing your life, I think. But then again, it's a personal thing, you know. I mean, I know that's why I find it more difficult to find time to paint than to take photographs, for example.
But it's interesting you picked on those two artists, because one without a child and one with a child, and Marina Abramović has stood up and talked about how difficult it is to be creative if you've got this other sort of responsibility. And one of the arguments we tried to bring out in the book is that, in a way, that's a rather old-fashioned school of thought.
But also, don't let's forget that Marina started off life as a performance artist, is part of a couple with Ule.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were famously together. So, you know, there was the sort of, what was it, Great Wall of China piece that they did together, and then they split after that. So that's just a sort of little caveat within that.
Well, can I ask you both about a little bit about the caveat of wider context? Because one sense is this is a beautiful undertaking. It's an extensive book. It obviously took some time. How aware were you of the prevailing dynamics? Because one feels like it's timeless in a sense. It's this very beautiful review of all of these things, but it's very timely as well if we think of these narratives about female empowerment, which are very prominent. You look at who's in the Oval Office. You're confronted with these issues front and centre. Were you aware as you were getting the book ready for publication that dynamics had maybe shifted, the tectonic plates had moved faster than perhaps you both realised when you set out on the project?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we were worried we were a bit behind the curve.
Because we had finished writing by the end of 2016.
Wow. Yeah. That's really, that was the moment. Did you sort of, did you look afresh then, or did you feel...
We've been part of it. You know, we're women working in the business, and we've both watched museums and galleries wrestle with how they do or don't represent female artists in their collection. I think the Prado had its first ever exhibition of a woman artist, Clara Peters, in 2016. You know, and it's been there for a very, very long time.
And
she's represented in the book.
Number one.
But we were very attuned to that. You know, there are important exhibitions that have happened in the last 10 years or so. Elle at the Pompidou, which rehung the entire Pompidou collection just based on female artists in a really sort of stimulating and provocative way. MoMA in New York produced a catalogue only of their female artists. And I think there might be some news about to be announced shortly. I think that the National Gallery might have acquired a rather important painting by an important female artist, a big gap in their collection. So the museum world has been having these conversations for a very long time and trying to sort of correct it as best they can. And there are a number of prizes out there, like the Freeland Art Prize, the Max Mara Prize at the Whitechapel Art Gallery, and Ivana Blazevic, and other important female directors like Frances Morris at Tate Modern, Maria Balshaw at Tate, have all been doing their work to ensure that women artists are highlighted. So we were very aware that now was the moment to really sort of record this And I think one of the conversations we had with the publishers when we were making it was that we were trying to make something that was very much of the moment. And the publishers were very interested to make something timeless. And it's interesting that you sort of suggest that it might be timeless. And I think that's partly to do with the historical essay that's in there. But it definitely feels to us now that there's an entire other chapter or 500 that we would want to add with all the other artists that we're sort of coming across all the time.
Yeah, one of my favourite paintings at the National Gallery is by Beth Morisot. And it's one of so few, at least last time I went to the National Gallery here in London. And then private art collectors have such huge collections of whether it's video-based art and performance-based art, or whether it's classic painting or whatever it might be, sculpture. Do you feel that the public sector has lagged behind private collections? You know, in the revolution in the art market, maybe in the last 20 years or so, do you feel that it's the collectors that are pulling the bootstraps of the public institutions up, I wonder?
A prize, I think, has just been announced in America in support of emerging female artists, and they'll have an exhibition as a result of winning this prize. But interestingly, the couple who have supported the prize, they have a collection of female-only artists, and the reason they gave for starting that collection was because it was cheaper to buy originally than it was to buy the big male hitters. So I think there is something there, possibly, about some of the private collectors feeling that they were more accessible. And I also think there are a lot of people out there who are much more interested in broadening the canon. They're not interested in the same old guys. You know, they want to feel that they're championing something. You look at Valeria Napoleone. She really wants to champion women artists. And I think that's a different thing to the market and to the institutions. I think the institutions have possibly watched that with interest. And a lot of our institutions have historically been run by very serious men and male artists. So, you know, we have a lot of unconscious bias, all of us, in everything that we do.
That's true. But actually, one of the exhibitions that we worked on together at the Portrait Gallery that was about women self-portraits, it was called Mirror Mirror, and that's something I did in 2000. But the reason I wanted to do that at the Portrait Gallery was that there were about 30 self-portraits by women artists in the collection and about 600 by men. So I thought, let me just do this because this is going to focus on that issue. And indeed, it has made a difference because then, you know, consequently, that part of the collection has grown. So I think that, you know, that is also part of our what informed wanting to do this. And I think that if you can make something that is going to be around, be serious, be some worthwhile contribution, then people are going to think about it more and then take it on board into their consciousness. The problem is if people feel that if it might be too partisan and too much about sort of hiving off women as a, thank you, yeah, about doing that.
One of the things that you have to do when you do this, you said that there are, you know, now 300 other artists you might want to include in whatever comes next, whatever projects you work on next. You've chosen, I mean, I'm looking at a bit where you've chosen like a work by each artist. That's a tough job to do. Are you finding something that is suiting your narrative, suits the chapter heading, or is just completely representative of that artist? Because it's so tough to do that. I mean, I'm looking at Lubaina Himid here, who won the Turner Prize last year.
Yes. Well, I didn't particularly want to put that piece in because I felt it has been too reproduced.
Yeah.
What we wanted to do is make the book have very familiar pieces that people would go, oh, yes, I know that, feel comfortable. And then other ones that they would be real discoveries. But that Lubaina piece, I just thought, but actually it's a beautiful painting. And there were also, there's the difficulty of getting the works that you want to have reproduced and the cost of getting those. And there are all other sorts of things that go into the sort of background of how you make a book like that. But if you look at that Cindy Sherman piece, this, I felt, was an unfamiliar picture of hers.
Yeah, exactly. There are plenty of those that have been sort of ripe for reproduction and kind of like very, very memorable. The Taryn Simon one that you've got in here is pretty, is quite a brutal, quite an arresting image.
Yeah.
And one I don't think I've seen before, strangely.
A very much
reproduced artist as well.
So, exactly. So, artists that are familiar with works that are less familiar, artists that are familiar with famous works attached to them, and then unknowns.
But we felt very strongly that we didn't want artists that were in there for the sake of being in there because their name was important. So we did really start with the images, and then we tried to understand what framework they were falling into. And then we did develop a narrative. We did use them in a sort of serpentine narrative that takes you from one work to another. But we tried not to be too manipulative in doing that, because, you know, we wanted to do justice to the works rather than sort of using them to our ends.
And just on that point about the narrative, did it reveal things to both of you in a way that's confounded you? I mean, that's just maybe a foolish question to ask of the authors of a piece, but, you know, did you feel you learned something about the secret to the genius of the way that women portray women by doing the book, if that makes sense?
It's a great question.
I think we tried to pull out some of the differences, and that was very much something that we felt we were tasked with doing in putting this book together. The revelations for us were that there were so many and so many more artists out there that we should know more about. That was one of the big revelations. The other things that we might draw out could also be generalizations. I think we felt that there's much more of a sort of self-critical, analytical, self-deprecating view that the artist has, most notably on themselves as a female artist rather than a male artist, where it tends to be slightly more about aggrandizement or, you know, pride. Much more of a focus maybe on the body, potentially. I think there's also, certainly in the contemporary, slightly more humour. I mean, I know there are male artists out there who are doing it, but, you know, the Kondo, for example. But it felt that women were able to maybe laugh at themselves in a slightly more easy way. But they are gross generalisations. I mean, ultimately, in trying to pull them out, we kept on feeling that we didn't want that to become the important message. What is important is that the quality of work that these artists are making is good.
To the point where it almost doesn't matter that it's a book by two women about female artists. Is that the kind of sharp end of the wedge, I wonder?
Yes.
It doesn't matter.
We always hoped that this would be an introduction to many people.
Yes,
so they'd find an artist like Jo Spence, and then they'd go, that's really interesting, that story's really interesting about her, let me look at some more. So it was always meant to be sort of a way in.
And this is not a book for people who are really in the trade so much as people who are interested in art, but not, they don't really know very much about it, and they just want to have a look, so that it would be, that it is a picture book with a very serious sort of underpinning, you know, historically and in terms of the text that talks about why these pictures should be occurring like this at this specific point of time. You know, the word accessible gets very bandied about, but, you know, I think high quality accessible is something very good to aim at.
Congratulations on the book. It is Madam and Eve, Women Portraying Women. Kathleen and Liz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, we started off by talking about how edifying we hoped this week's weekly would be. I couldn't feel any more edified right now.
Do you feel richly edified?
Quite. I'm going to leave with a spring in my step and great ideas and thoughts in my mind.
Everyone on the show is lovely. It's been wicked hanging out as usual. Should we thank our pals behind
Let's
the glass?
Let's do it, Rob.
Today's show was, of course, produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin, and our researcher was Amber Roberts.
The programme will return, of course, at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Robert Bounds. And thank you very much for tuning in.